Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program Number 638, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This has been recorded on June 15th of the year 2008. Happy Father's Day out there, and let me begin this broadcast, as always, by reminding you that For the Record is sort of a hybrid form of broadcasting. In addition to being listened to, it is meant to be read. And in that context, there's a huge and ever-growing body of information on a number of websites, including the SpitfireList.com website, the For the Record blog website, the For the Record supplemental material, sister station WFMU's streaming online real audio website, and their download website. There's even a mini library of old anti-fascist books available for download for free. So please use those websites, and use in particular the descriptions for the Record shows. Very often, the printed descriptions carry information that I did not have time to put into the main broadcast, because there's no time limit on the written descriptions, okay? Also, there is a page to click on to contribute to what I'm doing. And if you don't like what you hear, supporting what I'm doing is one of the best ways to fight back. And we're going to plunge right into the broadcast itself. We are in mid-June, and earlier this month we observed, or people observed, the 40th anniversary of Robert Kennedy's assassination. That took place right after Robert Kennedy had, for all intents and purposes, clinched the Democratic nomination for president in 1968. Of course, his death threw the race wide open, and eventually Hubert Humphrey was narrowly defeated by Richard Nixon. By the way, Saran Saran, the convicted assassin, or supposed assassin, of Robert Kennedy, was brought into the United States under the auspices of a couple of longtime personal friends and political supporters of Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon, of course, being the same Richard Nixon who won the 1968 presidency, the same Richard Nixon who was defeated by Robert Kennedy's brother John in 1960, the same Richard Nixon who just happened to be in Dallas, Texas on November 22, 1963, the same Richard Nixon who flew out about an hour and a half before President Kennedy was killed, and the same Richard Nixon who, when interviewed by the FBI in February of 1964, told the FBI that the only time he was in Dallas, Texas in 1963 was, quote, 2 days before, unquote, the assassination. This despite the fact that the New York Times and San Francisco Chronicle, among other newspapers, carried a UPI interview in Dallas, Texas with Richard Nixon, datelined November 21st, 1963, in their November 22nd editions. And of course, that was the day after he told the FBI he had been in Dallas, Texas. And you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes or Lieutenant Columbo to figure out that Richard Nixon was lying in his teeth. Slowly, over the years, there has been something of an erosion in the wall of cover-up around our assassinations. I was very surprised to see an article that appeared on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle on June 3rd of 2008, which, although it certainly could have gone much farther than it did, which it went much farther than I generally expected, a mainstream article to go, and certainly I didn't expect to see this on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle. The article is titled, 40 Years After Assassination, Questions Persist, subtitled, Were 13 Shots Fired? Was a Security Guard Involved? Who Wore the Polka Dot Dress? It's by Michael Taylor of the Chronicle, and it reads in part as follows, skipping down. Los Angeles police, who declined Monday to comment on their investigation, deemed the assassination an open-and-shut case. Saran did it by himself. Independent investigators who have looked at the case, however, over the years, however, suggest otherwise. Quote, the interesting thing is how underexamined the Robert Kennedy assassination is compared to President Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr., unquote, said David Talbot of San Francisco, author of Brothers, a book that looks into Robert Kennedy's own investigation into his brother's death and his conviction that JFK was the victim of a conspiracy. Quote, Bobby remains the unknown territory, Talbot said, again quoting, but even if you look at it minimally, there are questions that come to mind, unquote. Among them, Saran fired his .22 caliber revolver from a few feet in front of Kennedy, according to police, yet Los Angeles County Coroner Thomas Noguchi reported that the fatal shot was fired less than 1 inch from Kennedy's head, behind his right ear. Of the 4 shots fired at Kennedy, all came from the rear. None of this was raised at Saran's trial because the defense was based on the theory that he suffered from diminished capacity, unquote, rather than any challenge of prosecutors' evidence. Saran's revolver held 8 rounds. A radio reporter's tape recording of the shooting has sounds of what one audio expert describes as 13 shots. Saran never had a chance to reload before bystanders tackled him. 2 of the sounds on the tape are what forensic experts call double shots, unquote, which means 2 shots so close together that they couldn't have come from the same revolver. Several witnesses saw a security guard just behind Kennedy draw his revolver and run, reported seeing him fire it. Over the years, Saran has told investigators who interviewed him in prison that he was in a hypnotic trance during the shooting and can't remember it at all. He said he could not remember writing RFK Must Die. He did not respond to an interview request for this story. On the night Kennedy was killed, the hotel ballroom was filled with reporters celebrating his victory in the California primary and looking to the Democratic convention in Chicago. The last thing Kennedy said from the ballroom podium just after midnight was, "My thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there," unquote. In the pantry, as Kennedy moved through the crowd, he was surrounded by friends including Paul Schrade of the United Auto Workers, labor chairman for Kennedy's campaign. "All of a sudden, I got hit in the head by a bullet," Schrade said. "I shook violently. I thought I was being electrocuted. When I came to, I was on the floor," unquote. Schrade was one of 5 people beside Kennedy who were hit by bullets. For the past 33 years, he has been investigating the shooting. Unlike the JFK assassination, which created an outdoor crime scene in Dallas sprawling from the grassy knoll to the Texas School Book Depository, the shooting of Robert Kennedy happened in a confined space. Stray bullets ended up buried in walls and the ceiling where they could be tracked down. In photos, police investigators can be seen circling what they later said was a bullet hole in a ceiling panel behind where Saran fired. For Saran to have shot into that panel, he would have had to, quote, "either run around or the bullet would have had to make a U-turn," unquote, said Philip von Prague, a retired electrical engineer and audio expert who co-authored a book about the case. Then there was the mystery of the woman in the polka dot dress. According to witness Sandra Serrano, the woman fled from the hotel kitchen with an unidentified man shouting, quote, "We shot him! We shot him!" unquote. When a bystander asked who got shot, the woman said, "We shot Kennedy," unquote. Other witnesses reported seeing the woman, although it is not clear whether they heard that comment. In a new film about the assassination, RFK Must Die, Irish documentary filmmaker Shane O'Sullivan asked Serrano about what happened later. She said Los Angeles police spent hours trying to convince her she was wrong in what she saw, and she finally gave in. 40 years later, however, she told O'Sullivan that her original version was correct. In fact, the iconic polka dot dress is also something fixed in the mind of Saran himself. William Turner, a retired FBI agent who wrote a book about the case, says he interviewed Saran in prison in 1975. He told me, quote, "I don't remember anything after the woman in the polka dot dress asked me for coffee and heavy on the cream and sugar," unquote, said Turner, who lives in San Rafael. He said he had amnesia from that time until he was overpowered in the pantry after the shots were fired. He said, "I must have done it, but I don't remember." Turner thinks Saran was hypnoprogrammed to shoot and that he was a real-life Manchurian candidate, the fictional brainwashed dupe whose controllers want to assassinate a presidential candidate. Turner suspects the same villains as do the JFK conspiracy theorists, organized crime, and predominantly people from the CIA, unquote. Von Prague and a fellow investigator, former American Academy of Forensic Scientists President Robert Joling, didn't subscribe to any one conspiracy theory, but they are convinced more than one gunman was involved. The two have written a book about the killing whose title, "An Open and Shut Case," unquote, is a dig at the police investigation. Von Prague, a former senior instructor in commercial audio video systems for Ampex Corporation, analyzed a tape recording of the killing made by a Polish radio reporter. He said he heard 13 shots over 5 seconds, and was able to isolate the sounds well enough to say that 2 different weapons were firing during those 5 seconds. The Robert Kennedy assassination is something that I've dealt with at considerable length over the years in a number of different programs. The first available broadcast, that is first from a time standpoint, is AFA program number 9. That was recorded on June 5th of 1985, the 17th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. And you can order that from Spitfire. Hopefully by the end of the summer that'll be available online for download for free. Certainly, for the record, program number 582, which excerpts AFA program number 9 at considerable length, is available on the for the record. Well, the description is available on the Spitfire website, and the broadcast itself is available on streaming real audio on www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. One of the reasons that there apparently was a, quote, open and shut case, unquote, is that the two LAPD detectives who were involved with overseeing the LAPD's, quote, investigation, unquote, into the case, both had connections to the intelligence community and, in all probability, to the Central Intelligence Agency. It is also worth noting that there are evidentiary tributaries running between the Robert Kennedy assassination and America's other political assassinations. One of the elements of disinformation that was spread about the Kennedy assassination, namely that perhaps Fidel Castro and or the, quote, communists, unquote, were behind it, was that disinformation trail was laid down by an organization called American United, headed up by Anthony Hilder and John Steinbacher, two ultra-right-wing activists with strong fascist connections. And in Hilder's case, there are evidentiary tributaries suggesting the distinct possibility that Hilder may have had advanced knowledge of the Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King assassinations, and was associated with the milieu that was implicated in Jim Garrison's investigation into John Kennedy's assassination as well. One of the people who appears to have been an intelligence handler of Saran was a fellow named the Reverend Jerry Owen. He was a right-wing fundamentalist preacher and activist, and one of his followers, unquote, was a woman named Gail Aiken, who just happened to be the brother of Arthur Bremer, and he was the convicted assassin or supposed assassin of George Wallace. In fact, although he was seized on the spot, paraffin tests on Arthur Bremer were negative, indicating that he had not fired a gun. And as I observed in a miscellaneous archive show about the shooting of George Wallace, done, as a matter of fact, almost 20 years ago, that was in the summer of 1988, that would have meant that Arthur Bremer would have had to spit the bullets out of his mouth, kind of like Joe Isuzu. It's worth noting, too, that when George Wallace was shot and very badly wounded, that eliminated his presidential run. He was vying for the Democratic nomination, and there was considerable speculation that if, in fact, he did not get the 1972 Democratic nomination, and the odds were overwhelming that he wouldn't, that he might run as an independent candidate as he did in 1968, thereby jeopardizing the Republican/Nixon-Southern strategy that has become so well known in the years since. After, of course, George Wallace was eliminated, the racist vote went to Richard Nixon, who was the beneficiary of not only Robert Kennedy's assassination, but the shooting and political, although not biological, assassination of George Wallace. There are many evidentiary tributaries, again, running between Robert Kennedy's assassination and the assassination of President Kennedy. And it's worth noting, in something of a grim note, that the aforementioned Anthony Hilder and a number of researchers suspect him of involvement, certainly having foreknowledge of the Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King assassinations, and Anthony Hilder has dealt with at considerable length in the book The Assassination of Robert Kennedy by Bill William Turner and John Christian. William Turner was the gentleman to whom you heard the allusion in that article I read. And there are a number of evidentiary tributaries between Anthony Hilder, an ultra-right-wing activist, and the investigations into the assassinations of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. Lately, however, Anthony Hilder has turned up as one of the so-called truthers. He was prominently featured in a, quote, truth, unquote, symposium in San Francisco in the spring of 2004. And Anthony Hilder is featured prominently in a, quote, documentary, unquote, called Zeitgeist, which is really a fascist movie, although it presents itself as an anti-fascist film. It's actually fascist with strong fascist overtones and participation by a number of interesting people, including executives of the John Birch Society, and a prominent role in that film featured by Anthony Hilder. It goes to show you how things have evolved over the years. Zeitgeist, by the way, has been given away as a marathon premium by Pacifica Radio, which just goes to show what a long way down it really is. Arthur Brimmer, by the way, the convicted supposed assassin of George Wallace, a would-be assassin of George Wallace, was recently released from prison. We'll be talking about the assassination of George Wallace and the release of Arthur Brimmer in months to come. It is, of course, a presidential election year, and history is going to be made one way or another. For the first time, there is an African-American major party presidential candidate, of course, and that is Barack Obama. We'll be talking about Obama in months to come. One thing I was struck by, however, was the reinvigoration of the old O.J. Simpson case in the last couple of years, although one would not know it from the media coverage. In fact, there is a mountain of exculpatory evidence, not only proving that O.J. Simpson was innocent, but there's enough information on the public record to, in all probability, convict Mark Furman of the murders under the suspicion of guilt, consciousness of guilt clause. More about that in a second. The problem is that the public did not get told about the evidence, the exculpatory evidence that would have proved that O.J. Simpson was in fact innocent. The jury heard about it, but the public did not because the media did not do their job. And something of an aside and a bit of an editorial note, as outraged as I still, at the age of, for all practical purposes, 60 years old, as outraged as I get over some of these things, such as the media cover-up of the Kennedy of the O.J. Simpson case, or the disinformation being disseminated about September 11th, I'm brought back time and again to what really launched my career, such as it is, and that is the fact that when I studied the assassination of President Kennedy back in the early and mid-70s, it was apparent that the media were not doing their job, and they were not telling the truth, and that there was a very credible, verifiable body of evidence that one could access from printed sources that proved that the media, chiefly the electronic media, but also the mainstream print media, were not doing their job. And they didn't do the job in the O.J. Simpson case as well. The O.J. Simpson case has come to light, and a couple of different things brought it to light. There was a book published by Regan Books, a subsidiary company of News Corp, run by right-wing media magnate Rupert Murdoch. That book was called If I Did It, and that sent all the wags to intoning about how, say, this proved O.J.'s guilt. In fact, the book was somewhat sympathetic to O.J. Simpson, and even a cursory reading of it would indicate that even if O.J. Simpson had wanted to commit those murders, he didn't know enough about combat weaponry to do it. More about that at some point in the future, perhaps. But what's interesting is the political overtones of the O.J. Simpson case, and what I wonder, and this is pure speculation, and I want to stress that, what I wonder is if perhaps the O.J. Simpson case was being resuscitated to help polarize politics, electoral politics, in the year of our Lord 2008. One of the things we're going to talk about in connection with Barack Obama is the very strong indication that he is being badjacketed, that for some time, elements associated not only with the Bush administration, the Republican Party, but even beyond that with the underground Reich and with Islamist fascist elements, have been deliberately grouping around Barack Obama for whatever reason, and I suspect it may have been to deliberately taint him in order to assure a Republican victory. That's when you deliberately float disinformation, or when you deliberately taint something, that's a technique that the intelligence community calls badjacketing, and that there are indications that Barack Obama has been the focal point of badjacketing by elements associated with Karl Rove, George Bush, the Islamists, even the Bank Altaqua, or certainly elements that have tributaries running in the direction of Bank Altaqua, Al-Qaeda, the Islamic Institute of Grover Norquist, and Talat Otman. More about that, though, in months to come when I talk about the apparent badjacketing of Barack Obama. I wonder to what extent, and this is pure speculation, the floating, the reinvigoration of the O.J. Simpson case might have been to polarize things from a racial standpoint in order to assure that, or attempt to assure that McCain, Bush Light, so to speak, would become president of the United States. We'll talk perhaps about the O.J. Simpson case when I do broadcasts about the apparent bad jacketing of Barack Obama. That later in the year, however. I do want to note that not only was the If I Did It book published by a subsidiary company of News Corp, Regan Books, but Judith Regan, who was involved, she was the head of that company, she also was having a steamy, passionate affair with the then-married Bernard Kerik, a New York City police official, and they were basically doing the wild thing in a penthouse overlooking the still-smoking ruins of the World Trade Center, and we should note that Bernard Kerik was George W. Bush's first choice to head up the Department of Homeland Security. But Kerik himself has some imbroglios, some peccadillos, some skeletons in the closet, so to speak. I'd simply note that the If I Did It book has some strong political overtones, and that the publication of that book was affected by people who have a vested interest in the Bush administration and in far-right politics in the United States. Also, of course, O.J. Simpson got stung attempting to get a hold of some sports memorabilia that had belonged to him. Interestingly enough, the FBI knew about this in advance and was apparently taping the whole thing, or at least intended to. Article about that in the AP, and this is an article by Linda Deutsch and Ken Ritter. FBI knew of O.J. Simpson plan in advance. It's Dateline L.A. Federal agents learned 3 weeks in advance that O.J. Simpson and a memorabilia dealer planned an operation to retrieve personal items Simpson said were stolen from him, according to FBI reports obtained Friday by the Associated Press. Dealer Thomas Riccio said he reported to the FBI on August 21st that a collector claimed to have belongings taken from Simpson and that Simpson wanted to videotape the confrontation with the person peddling thousands of pieces of his memorabilia. Riccio told AP that he raised the subject while talking with the FBI about an unrelated subject, a video of Anna Nicole Smith. But he said agents dismissed his report, telling him, quote, they didn't want to be involved in another weird celebrity case, unquote. Quote, the guy flat out told me he had items stolen from O.J.'s house, unquote, Riccio told the AP, again quoting, I have a legitimate business. Well, that raises a number of interesting questions. First of all, were these items stolen from O.J.'s house? When were they stolen from O.J.'s house? Who, in fact, stole them? I mentioned that there may very well be enough information. There's certainly a lot of information on the public record implicating Mark Furman himself in the O.J. Simpson case, and we'll talk about that in a second. It might very well be enough to convict Furman of the murders under the consciousness of guilt clause. I'm not an expert on how that's applied in the context of jurisprudence. We'll talk about that in a second, but there's an interesting sports memorabilia connection to the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. We should also note that the world of professional sport and the world of sports memorabilia themselves have a lot of connections to the world of organized crime. There were many evidentiary tributaries running between the world of organized crime and the O.J. Simpson case. Interestingly enough, there was a guy named Dwayne Garrett, who was a talk show host on radio station KGO-AM. He was, interestingly enough, a political operative. He had worked for, among others, Robert Kennedy, and was a longtime Democratic political operative and activist. He also was deeply involved in sports memorabilia, in addition to being a major talk show host. And he mentioned about a week after the killings of Ron and Nicole that O.J. Simpson had allegedly been offered several millions of dollars by Edward J. DeBartolo Jr., the owner of the San Francisco 49ers, to buy a new NFL franchise, or to become the owner of a new NFL franchise. This would have made O.J. Simpson the first black NFL franchise owner, but according to the late Dwayne Garrett, O.J. turned the offer down because of the apparent organized crime connections of Edward J. DeBartolo. By the way, those apparent organized crime connections or alleged organized crime connections are discussed at considerable length in For the Record 304 about the NFL and the mob and gambling. That's called Illegal Procedure. Interestingly enough, shortly after Dwayne Garrett mentioned this, he began getting death threats, and about a year after he made that statement on one of his broadcasts, he went off the Golden Gate Bridge, an alleged suicide, despite the fact that a number of Japanese tourists, among others, who were under and at the Golden Gate Bridge at that time, did not report seeing the rather large Mr. Garrett come plunging off of the bridge. So rest in peace, Dwayne Garrett. I wonder what might have happened. When were these items stolen from O.J.'s house? And who stole them? And it's interesting that the FBI knew about this in advance. Did they do anything about the stolen items? Who knows? It's worth noting that elements of the FBI actually testified on behalf of the plaintiffs in the civil case. When was the last time you heard of the FBI getting involved in a civil case? Very, very, very unusual. And one of the things that I wonder about in connection with the resuscitation of the O.J. Simpson case and the racial polarization that calls to mind, again, we're in an election year and the Republicans have always used the race card in a big way. We now, for the first time, have an African-American major party candidate. As discussed in numerous broadcasts in connection with the O.J. Simpson case, there were numerous intelligence links to that investigation. Now, a week after some of the things that the public didn't get told, a week after the killings, there was a report submitted by three deputy district attorneys, including a woman named Lucien Coleman, who was a 17-year veteran of the DA's case. These were submitted to Marcia Clark, indicating that there was strong evidence that Mark Furman had been having an affair with Nicole Brown Simpson. And generally, assistant DAs do not help the defense in a capital murder case. The reason that they were giving that to Marcia Clark, was that Mark Furman was funky, to say the least. Mark Furman, by the way, as was indicated in the LAPD personnel files, was the head of a white supremacist group within the Los Angeles Police Department, an acronym WASP, standing for White Anglo-Saxon Policeman. It's worth noting that the aforementioned Mark Furman was the guy who conducted the altogether illegal search of O.J.'s property, which netted the, quote, evidence, unquote. Mark Furman's white supremacist connections were not permitted into evidence, despite the fact that O.J. and Nicole were getting written and telephone death threats, including sexually explicit threats made to Nicole, from white supremacist groups, including some associated with the Los Angeles Police Department. That was never admitted into evidence because Judge Lance Ito's wife, Ito was the judge presiding over the case, had been Mark Furman's watch commander. His wife was the highest-ranking female member of the LAPD, and she had had to discipline Mark Furman when he wrote KKK on the Martin Luther King holiday on the calendar on the station house wall. But again, that was not admitted into evidence because Judge Ito claimed that he did not have a conflict of interest. I would also note in this context that Mark Furman, according to the book Blood Oath, lied on the stand about where he was and what he was doing during the pre-trial hearings. He said that he was at a Police Protective League barbecue in La Quinta, California, but in fact, that took place the night before. And all of those things taken together might very well be enough to convict Mark Furman of the consciousness of guilt, or under the consciousness of guilt statute, depending on how that might be applied. I've alluded to many broadcasts. I did a lot of work on the O.J. Simpson case. All of those broadcasts are available for download on the WFMU download site. And there are also written descriptions of many of those broadcasts, not annotated, as in some of the recent cases. A lot of information on the web. Please take advantage of that, because if the many allusions to past broadcasts don't make sense, they will if you use those archives. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 638, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on June 15th of 2008. My name is Dave Emery. Happy Father's Day.